If you'd open up to Mark chapter 10, we're going to be in the third of these three passion predictions that Jesus gives in this central part of the Gospel of Mark. So as we're continuing here, we're going to continue along many of the same themes that we've been studying. But I wanted to begin with just making a reference I might have referred to before. There's a book that I was interested in reading as I think of my ties to the Baltimore Ravens, and football rolls are around again this year. We're almost through the off season, the dreaded off season. But Brian Billick had packaged himself as sort of the leadership guru. And he had done a lot of research into leadership styles that could be applicable to all different types of organizations, sports organizations, business organizations. And so he had written a book called Competitive Leadership, 12 Principles for Success. And he went through and he quoted extensively from different ones that he had studied that had quotes that were apropos and that helped him glean some of these principles. Just as you look down through the table of contents, you know, I won't read them all, but, you know, be prepared, be self-disciplined, be knowledgeable. Be self-assured, be courageous, be a communicator, be a motivator. A lot of different topics that he has here. And as I went through that book, what struck me was the glaring omission, what was not there, and that was the emphasis that Jesus Christ has on the servanthood model of leadership. Be a servant is what Jesus has to say. The greatest leader of all time. Here you've devoted your life to researching this topic, and you have this book that you put out, and it omits the key ingredient that Christ says is essential for effective leadership. So I sent a little note. I didn't get anything back. Didn't expect to get anything back. But that's what is missing here. And on another sort of similar vein, one of the commentators, the preachers that I like to listen to as we go through Mark is Brian Borgman. And in his introduction to this passage, he said that he took the theme of leadership, and he was curious how many books have been written on the theme of leadership. So he went to Amazon.com, and you can do this. I did this myself. Plug in leadership, and when I did it, I came up with 228,829 results. That's a lot of books. 228,829. I don't even see how that's possible. He said he did it and came up with 7,000. So I'm probably greatly in error. I didn't try and scroll down and document anything. I just typed it in the search button there, and that's what it came back. Maybe I'm searching the whole internet instead of just Amazon in terms of what I'm doing. So I might be faulty here. But then he went and refined his search, and he said, I just am interested in, of all these books that relate to leadership, he came up with 7,000. He said, of all these books, how many deal with servanthood model? And of course, he came up with very few. I think he came up with 11, he said. And some of those didn't even apply. So it just shows you that people, the world misses the truth that Jesus is trying to present here. Things are just topsy-turvy in terms of what the world says is the pathway to greatness and how you attain to greatness and what's all involved with status and what's all involved with self-esteem and self-worth and all these things. The world gets it all wrong. The path to greatness that the world puts forth is not the path to greatness that Christ explains. Now, the world's way, it certainly works in the world. If you look in the business world, the people that follow these different models and these suggestions, they're able to crawl to the top of the ladder. They're able to get up to the top where they can lord it over others, and they can have some type of dominion. But it's sadly, it's not what God has for the church, even though within the church, you see the church copying and modeling itself tragically in many ways after the world. I mean, it's the world that has this concept of a CEO, and he is the visionary, and he's the one that everything works through, and the church adopts, you know, that type of strategy. It's the world that just thinks everything is about, you know, making it easy for this one individual to be catered to and to have everything done for him so that he can be so essential and so important and so crucial, when God says, well, we want this person to be the servant of all. We want him to be last, not first, in order to demonstrate what true leadership is all about. So we're going to see in this passage in Mark chapter 10 It's going to be the same lesson that Jesus taught back in chapter 8, if you remember chapter 8, verse 31, the first of these passion predictions that Jesus gave. It says in chapter 8, verse 31, he says, "The Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him. When he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later." And then you have the reaction to the disciples and Jesus giving teaching to counter the false understanding and the lack of knowledge on the part of the disciples. Comes up again in chapter 9. You get to the same point in chapter 9, verse... Actually, I quoted chapter 9 instead of chapter 8 there. So chapter 8, I should have backed up to chapter 8, 31 and quoted that, but I did quote chapter 9, verse 31. And then you get the same instruction in chapter 10. Jesus gives a passion prophecy. It's followed by a reaction on the part of the disciples, which reveals that they don't really get it in terms of the pathway to greatness. And then Jesus gives different lessons to the disciples. The lesson he has for us today is that suffering and sacrificial service is the path to greatness in the kingdom. Suffering and sacrificial service, not what people are lining up to sign up for. Not self-seeking, not self-promotion, which is the world's way of going after greatness. So I divided this into basically two chunks. The first one is the passion prophecy itself in verses 32 to 34. This is his third of the three passion prophecies. He's going to emphasize that you have to endure this suffering before glory. You can't shortcut, you can't skip this step of suffering. You can't lose focus on the suffering and just look only at the glory to follow. And so that's the substance of 32 to 34. And then in 35 to 45, we're going to see the contrast between fleshly leadership and spiritual leadership as the disciples get again into this issue of who's the greatest, who's going to sit on the right hand and the left hand. And Jesus goes and gives instruction as to not the world's concept of leadership I want you to follow, but I want you to follow the spiritual concept. So we'll begin in verse 32. Let's read verses 32 to 34. They were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking on ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were fearful. And again, he took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was going to happen to him, saying, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and they will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him. And 3 days later, he will rise again." Jesus knows that he has to reiterate his message over and over again to the disciples. Even though this is something that he's spoken of previously, as we've seen, he now takes up the subject in a little more detail and fleshes it out a little bit more in detail, because he knows that in order for his disciples to have confidence and courage, it requires repeated and reinforced revelation. That's important for us to know. If we want to have confidence and courage in our Christian life, if we want our children, if we want them to grow up with confidence and courage in their walk with the Lord, they need repeated and reinforced revelation. It's not a one-time mention and people get it. The disciples didn't get it that way. We know we don't get it that way. We look at our church situations and we see that our church situations still struggle with the core concepts that are embedded in these verses that we're studying this morning. It's so important that God's message be repeated and be reinforced. So we start with Jesus on his journey here. The destination has been determined. He knows where he's headed. It's named here as Jerusalem, so it's no mystery. It says they were on the road. They were going up because in a geographical sense, it's a heightened elevation in order to, from wherever you are, to go up to the mountain area to Jerusalem. It's about 3,500 feet in elevation compared to Jericho. Jerusalem's only 20 miles from Jericho, but it's 3,500 feet higher in elevation. And so you're going up in that geographic, physical sense of the terrain, but you're also going up in the sense that the Psalms of the Ascents, you're studying those. I think the ladies are studying those in Psalm 120 to 134 as the pilgrims who would worship come to Jerusalem on those appointed feast days, as they would sing these songs of praise on their journey as they would go up to Jerusalem to worship. Here you have Jesus. He is going up, bringing himself as that ultimate lamb of sacrifice. He, as our great high priest, is now offering up himself as the spotless Lamb of God to take away the sins of the world. And he is on this mission and will not be deterred. It says he's fixed. His destiny is determined, and he's set himself to go up to Jerusalem. Now, his destiny is one that he has embraced. He has embraced this destiny. He knows the destination, and he's embraced his destiny. It says, and Jesus was walking on ahead of them. So it's interesting here, he's not walking, Mark makes a point to say he's not walking in conjunction with them, arm by arm, hand by hand, side by side. He is now striding with large strides. He's ahead of them, leading the way, showing that he is not reluctantly going to the cross. He's not being driven by others or being dragged to the cross or in any way expressing reservation, but he understands why it is that he came into this world. He understands the purpose of his incarnation, why it is that God had prepared a body for him to offer that body up on the cross and to be killed. And so he now is leading the way and is, in a sense, eagerly, even though the weight of all that lies ahead of him, think of what must be going through his mind as he's now somewhat alone with his thoughts. He's not conversing at this point. He's ahead of the other disciples. He's locked in. You probably could see it in his eyes and in his countenance. You could probably see the determination that he has, the resolve that he's embracing his destiny. He's aware of all that lies ahead of him. Hendrickson says he already senses something of the hypocrisy, the calumny, the mockery, the pain, the shame, which like an avalanche threatens to overwhelm him. Yet he does not retreat or even stand still. With unflinching determination, he walks right into it, for he knows that this is necessary in order that his people may be saved. So he embraces his destiny, but you look at the reaction on the part of his disciples, and it's quite different. They recognize that they are in the midst of something dramatic. Mark is very good at unfolding the drama of the various events and sort of the pathos that's involved in what's taking place, whereas the Gospel of John is much more about the discourses of Jesus and the theological content. Mark picks up much more on the drama of the particular events. And so it says the reaction here, it says the reaction of the 12 is that they were amazed. And then apparently it divides up another group. It says, and those who followed, as if there's another group of disciples in a more general sense, that you have the 12 that are closest to him, they're following right after him, but then the ones following after that are a greater group of the disciples. So you have two different reactions. The reaction, I think there's two groups here. The reaction of the 12 says that they were amazed. See, they were amazed at the demeanor of Jesus, at the submission and the obedience of Jesus, at his willingness to embrace his destiny, because they knew that was so different than themselves, and they didn't fully understand. Jesus has just been unfolding it by way of progressive revelation. They were just coming to a little bit of a grasp, but they didn't know that the weight of what Jesus faced, the physical suffering and the physical death, was not even the greatest part. It was the spiritual separation from his Father to pay the penalty for sin that would be the greatest part of his agony. And they had no concept, really, of what that would involve. And so they stand here yet amazed at how Jesus could be so focused on this mission of going to the cross. The other followers, it says here that they're characterized by being alarmed, by being fearful. I mean, certainly by virtue of identifying with Jesus, if you knew what lay ahead for Jesus, you certainly would be somewhat fearful of what you might experience as well. John chapter 9, verse 22. John 9, 22 says that if anyone confessed Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. In other words, they were aware of persecution and suffering that was going to come to those who were aligned with Jesus and who would confess him before men. And so as they go to Jerusalem, there's some reluctance, certainly, and fear on the part of these followers. John chapter 11, verse 8, the disciples say, well, you're not going to go up to Jerusalem. I mean, the Jews are going to seek to stone you. You're not going to go there again to this place, are you? And so you see this recognition on the part of the followers of Jesus that there's going to be hard times ahead. And so there's this aspect of fear that's involved in terms of their reaction. But Jesus goes ahead, it says. It says, again, he took the 12 aside. So of these two groups, he focuses in on his most intimate disciples, the 12. He takes them aside, and he begins to tell them what was going to happen to him. So he's now communicating the details that lie ahead in order to calm their fears. He's concerned for their emotional strength and courage going forward. He knows that he's passing on a baton of leadership, and here he is trying to give them much more content, much more. He's setting their expectations so that they won't be shocked and surprised as they see these events unfold, that they'll be reassured that these are things that Jesus predicted in advance, which is quite telling by way of prophecy when you think of the level of detail that Jesus is going to share here with his disciples. It's something that could only be by virtue of him having intimate knowledge of the Old Testament scripture. He knew the prophecies of Psalm 22, the prophecies of Isaiah 53, as we studied through the book of Isaiah. He knew the details of those particular prophecies and how he was going to fulfill them. And beyond that, he had his own omniscient knowledge, his own communication with the Father, his own knowledge of what lay ahead. He's the one that's able to tell the future and to proclaim these details, which is why people who are liberals and skeptics, they come to passages like this and they say, well, this had to have been written after the fact, no way he could have given the specifics that he did here ahead of time. But that's exactly, of course, what he did in communicating these details. So he goes on and he shows that the majority, the focus of what he has to communicate deals with the way of the cross. Everything that's related to his rejection, to his trials, to his punishment and physical suffering, and then to the actual death on the cross. That's where the emphasis is. The resurrection is there as well, tagged on at the end, but it certainly doesn't have the same weight of focus as the path of the cross does. And yet we're going to see the disciples, they don't get where the focus of the whole passage is here for Jesus. They don't pick up on that. They sort of want to skip over that, shortcut that, and jump just to the glory portion. But Jesus says one must embrace suffering before glory. You can't shortcut the pathway to glory. You must embrace this suffering. And so he goes and he gives this understanding that he's going to be delivered over, first of all, to the religious leaders. Behold, we're going up to Jerusalem, the Son of Man, his favorite title for himself, speaking of his incarnation, of his humiliation, of his identification with mankind, the prophetic aspect that Daniel 4 had spoken of in terms of the kingdom aspect of the Son of Man, all these things wrapped up in this title. It says the Son of Man is going to be delivered over to these religious rulers. In the book of Matthew, it adds the elders to this chief priests and the scribes, but these make up the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court that the Jews have. They're the ones that are not able to put him to death, but will be able to hand him over, as it is, to the political rulers. So he's going to be judged and sentenced. It says they're going to, in terms of the political rulers, he's going to be condemned to death by the Jewish religious leaders, who will hand him over to the Gentiles for the actual execution and the actual putting him to death. So he's going to go through this process that we're going to see in the last chapters here in Mark, as he gets delivered up to the religious leaders. He gets sentenced, so he's condemned to death, and then he's presented for execution by being delivered over to the Gentiles. R.C. Sproul, he had an interesting comment from the Old Testament imagery of what happened on the Day of Atonement that he felt was apropos to this section. He says, if you read back in Leviticus 16 about the Day of Atonement, you see that they had an animal that was killed, and its blood was spread on the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. And then the sins of the people were symbolically transferred to the back of what was called the scapegoat. And the scapegoat was then driven out into the wilderness. It was driven outside of the camp into utter darkness. And so you see the picture of the sins being taken away and being carried off by this scapegoat. And he said that's what it was to be a Jew, as Jesus is, and to be delivered over to the Gentiles, to be taken out of the camp, outside of the camp, of what was sacred and what was holy in terms of the temple and the temple worship. You're handed over outside the camp like this scapegoat is in order to be off in the place where you didn't have the presence of God, and you have him going to be able to remove the sins off in that fashion. But it goes into the detail here. Jesus talks about what's going to be involved in the humiliating treatment that's going to ensue. It says these are details that aren't in the first two passion prophecies. He says they will mock him. They will spit upon him. There's nothing that is more of an indignity than that we see in our culture. If that happens in a sporting event or that happens somewhere, I mean, just the uproar over how this could be, because it is just such a statement of humiliation. And people have such a reaction against it, but this was just part of his overall experience, he says, as he was mocked, he was spit upon, and then, of course, it says here he was scourged in a way that the Romans had employed tactics where they had bits of metal and glass and stones embedded into the whip in order that it would tear the flesh up. And so he goes into these accounts, which of course match exactly with the picture that we see in the book of Isaiah of one whose visage is so marred and he's so disfigured and he has no handsome appearance anymore, as he's just so scarred and disfigured by the punishment that took place here. So all of this takes place leading up to the final execution of the death on the cross, where he simply says he's going to be killed. They're going to kill him. But that for Jesus is not the end of the story, and he doesn't want the disciples to have the expectation that, hey, that's where things end. And so he's taking this moment to take them aside, to communicate to them, to reinforce their faith, to build them up, and to say, but what's going to happen after that? There's going to be victory. There's going to be vindication. He says, 3 days later, he will rise again. So you need to understand and embrace suffering. You can't shortcut and skip that step, but you will end up united with Jesus in this state of glory and of triumph and of victory, as Jesus 3 days later will rise again. But we know from the parallel accounts that the disciples, they just don't get the teaching. In fact, Luke chapter 18, the parallel passage here, as it records the response of the disciples, Luke 18:34, it says, but the disciples understood none of these things. That's not a very good record for a student, you know? I mean, if you're trying to teach something, and you have your teacher survey afterwards, and you figure out, well, how did I do by way of communication? What did they pick up here? The disciples understood none of these things. The meaning of this statement was hidden from them. They did not comprehend the things that were said. How many ways can Luke express that the disciples didn't get it? Okay? And God didn't allow them to get it. And didn't illuminate them in that sense. So that's the third passion prophecy. The emphasis that there will be this need to embrace suffering before glory. The way of the cross must be understood. The way of the cross must be followed. The way of the cross cannot be avoided. And yet, the disciples don't get it. And so, verses 35 to 45, this second section, shows the contrast between fleshly leadership, how the world approaches greatness, and spiritual leadership, what the true pathway is to greatness via suffering, via sacrificial service. We begin, again, with the reaction on the part of the disciples. Once again, they get embroiled in this controversy over who's going to be the greatest. And here it comes by way of a presumptuous request for exalted positions of power and prestige. It says in James and John, verse 35, the two sons of Zebedee, they came up to him, saying to him, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Wow, that's a mouthful. If you're a parent, you might have heard similar types of expressions from young, immature children from time to time of a daddy or a mommy. I want you to promise me now you're not going to say no, you know, before I'm going to tell you. I want you to promise, I'm going to ask you something. I want you to promise me you're going to say yes. Whoa, that's a red flag, isn't it, when something comes with a blank check and says, I want you to embrace this. Well, this presumptuous request, it's rooted, first of all, it's rooted in a sense of entitlement, a sense of absorption with self, of self-seeking, of self-promotion. You have James and John, and apparently from the parallel account, it says it's actually their mother that comes to make the request. So it's a family thing. They're all involved. The mother's involved. The sons, James and John, are involved. But they're taking this opportunity. For some reason, they thought that this was I think it's because time's getting short. They understand that we're now, you know, weeks away. We're not in terms of months away. We're not in terms of years away. The window is getting short to sort of nail down what's our position going to be in this upcoming kingdom. And so they take the opportunity here to come to Jesus, and they come in a very childish, immature way, as if asking him to give them some type of a blank check, because they think that they are special. Okay? They think, look, we're not just the 12 who've given up everything to follow Jesus, as we talked about, you know, a week ago. We're not just in the 12. We're in that select group, that intimate group of associates with Jesus, where he includes us in the most intimate times in his life. Now, how they could leave Peter out, you know, I wonder what Peter thought about all this. They certainly didn't have a Roman Catholic concept that Peter had been given the keys to the kingdom and was the one that was in charge of everything, and that they were going to be in a submissive role to Peter. They certainly didn't have that type of understanding of Peter's role here, because they leave Peter out as well as the rest of the 12, and they come with their mother, they come together to Jesus to make this inquiry. They're interested in who's going to have the positions of power and of prestige and all of this, but they have this sense of entitlement. They think they're special. They think that, look, we have done something that God needs. We've done something that brings value by way of our ministry, and God is somehow in debt to us and should repay that debt by giving us these important privileged positions. Just want to mention some things. Brian Borgman had some good thoughts on this aspect of how is it that we can serve God in a wrong way? How can we serve God in a way where we think we make him entitled to give us certain benefits? Like, we're so important. He needs our service. He doesn't need our service. Psalm 123, verse 2. Psalm 123, verse 2 says, verse 1, to you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in the heavens. Behold, as the eyes of servants look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maid to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God until he is gracious to us. In other words, the relation of us serving the Lord is ones where we're looking to the Lord as the one who's the all-sufficient one who provides all of our needs. We don't have anything that we bring to the table that God needs. We are not meeting any needs on the part of God. It's not like we are in this, we're so special and our ministry is so special that God can't get the job done without us, and now we are deserving of special recognition and special benefits and, you know, all of these things. And yet, I think in the church, I think sometimes ministers of the gospel feel that way. They feel like their ministry is so essential and so important, it's so crucial, God's so dependent upon it, as if they are, you know, making God in their debt to some sense. But turn over to Acts chapter 17, please. Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17, where Paul is speaking there to the men of Athens. He says in verse 24, the God who made the world and all things in it. Okay, this is the God who is self-sufficient, who is in need of nothing that we can offer. This is the God who created all things. He is also the Lord of heaven and earth. He's in control. He's sovereign over all things. He does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything. Since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things, he is the giver. He is not the one who is in need. We should never think of ourselves as some type of special category where we are coming and meeting some need on God's part. And yet I think that's part of what the attitude was here of the sons of Zebedee. As they come here and they have this sense of entitlement, of absorbed with their self. Their mother, it seems, Salome, she seems to have been a sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus. So actually they're probably cousins of Jesus. They have a close personal connection, family connection, ministry connection. They would seem to be special in a lot of ways, but they cannot come before God and claim some type of special status that puts God in their debt. Their request as well is rooted in ignorance of God's overall program and an inflated opinion of themselves. Because Jesus says to them, well, what do you want me to do for you? I'm not gonna respond to some blank check. You know, you guys think you're way too important. And you don't even understand the types of things that you're asking, it turns out. Because they say, when Jesus says, okay, well, refine your requests a little bit, it's interesting, he doesn't upbraid them. He doesn't react harshly to them in rebuke. He's very patient. He's very gentle in his response to them. He's very gracious. He basically says, well, what do you want me to do? And they say more specifically, well, grant that we may sit in your glory, one on your right and one on your left. It's interesting that all that Jesus had just communicated to try and define their expectations, they had missed the point of all of that and had jumped ahead to just the aspect of the millennial kingdom and what would happen when Jesus would reign. But it's also interesting that the nature of the kingdom they expected was something that would take place on earth. It was something that would have them and other people in positions of administration and of rule and of importance and significance. It wasn't just some heavenly existence that didn't have any of this type of administration involved. So they had very much the view of the millennial kingdom that we've been proclaiming as we've gone through Isaiah and some of our prophetic studies. So I think this is a good passage to give a little glimpse as to what their expectation was of the nature of the kingdom. Here they are basically presenting this presumptuous request that's rooted in a sense of entitlement and rooted in a sense of ignorance of God's overall program, inflated opinion of themselves. So in his patient response here, Jesus goes ahead and he promises them suffering, but he ends up deferring. On the question of preferential positions, he ends up putting that off and saying, well, look, I can't make commitments to you in that particular area. What he says to them in verse 38, he said, you do not know what you are asking for. He gets back to their ignorance. They're ignorant regarding what lies ahead for Jesus. And so he's pointing out their ignorance. He says, look, you're not able to drink the cup that I drink. You're not able to be baptized with the baptism with which I baptism. You don't know that those things for me, while they speak, these images speak to the depth of suffering and all that's involved in sort of the overwhelming sense of the afflictions and all that will come upon me. There are things, you think that might be you? Go ahead. They're thinking that Jesus is saying, these are things that you cannot possibly participate in. They have a redemptive aspect to them. They have a substitutionary, atoning death aspect to them that you will never be able to participate in. You have no clue what my mission is. You don't understand what I'm going forward to achieve. You're asking to share the cup and to share the baptism. And he says, this is really something out of ignorance that you're asking here. And so he tries to correct them as he goes through these two images of the cup and of the baptism. He says, look, you don't have the capability. You're not able to do that. Now listen to the reaction on the part of the disciples. It's so arrogant. It's so presumptuous. It's so self-confident. Despite what Jesus has said again to them, they still confess and testify, yes, we are able. You know, Dean can do it. You know, we are able. You know, they just have no concept of what is going to be required, and they think that they can fit the bill. John MacArthur says here, this is arrogant, overconfident, it's audacious, it's ridiculous. It's like Peter in Luke 22 saying, I'll never betray you. I'll never betray you. Then he goes right after that and he does it. It's an overestimation based on pride. This is typical of human pride. It's self-promoting. It's selfishly ambitious. It's arrogantly overconfident. It assumes it can accomplish anything. You know, it's like after the Olympics and they interview someone and they're going to say in a couple of weeks, they're going to say, you can do anything you want if you just try hard enough. If you just work hard enough, you know, you can be the, you know, Olympian champion at this or that if you would just try hard enough. I don't think so, you know. And there are some things we have to say we're not able, you know. We lack what the abilities are. And so Jesus, he goes and he patiently clarifies for them. Okay, he says, as I digest what your request is here, he says, there is a sense in which you are going to share in my cup and baptism. You're not going to share in it fully. You're not able to do the things that are involved from a redemptive standpoint, from a standpoint where you need to be an unblemished sacrifice to offer yourself up as that lamb to take away the sins of the world. You're not going to participate in any of that. But when we speak of suffering and of persecution and of what's going to be involved, yes, there is a sense in what lies ahead for you. Jesus promises them that what lies ahead for them is suffering after the pattern of Jesus. They're going to walk in the steps of the Master. They're going to drink the cup. They're going to be baptized with the baptism in some sense. And of course, we see the martyrdom of James as the first one that is experiencing that. And then we see how John, at the end of his life, all the suffering that he endured on Patmos, whether he was martyred or not is a little bit of an open question. Maybe he was not, but at least the aspect of suffering and drinking the cup and the baptism is certainly here. But then Jesus gets to this specific question that they had asked, but to sit on my right or on my left, this is not mine to give. It's for those for whom it has been prepared. He defers on this question because it gets into the sovereignty of God who has foreordained before all eternity. God has set up his program and he has the roles that each of us are going to play. And we see that these roles are determined by God, and they are not based on what the disciples and what James and John, from a worldly perspective, thought they would be based on in terms of, well, look, my participation to date, in terms of how I have ministered in this way, my closeness to you from a family standpoint, from a personal standpoint, we think these things have earned us this and that. And Jesus is saying, no, these positions are going to be handed out by the sovereign disposition of my Heavenly Father. And I'm not speaking to that issue at the moment, but I will speak to you in the general principle as to what the path of greatness is. And I want to now contrast it in verses 41 to 45, this pattern reversal that Jesus presents to show that spiritual leadership is so different from what the people of this world consider to be leadership. Spiritual leadership involves sacrificially serving others. All of fleshly leadership is rooted in pride. It has a goal of self-advancement. That's why when the other disciples heard this interaction between James and John and Jesus, it says after they heard of this interaction, the other 10, they began to feel indignant with James and John. Well, we would have the same reaction because we would actually have the same selfish ambition that James and John have. We would be concerned about, well, wait a minute, you know, it's like the game of survival, you know, you're getting alliances and they moved ahead of us and they've tried to strike a deal and they're playing their cards before we got to play ours. And in this strategic alliance of where you make your move, now they're concerned and they're indignant over, hey, we might lose out in terms of standing in the future kingdom. And so they're very upset that James and John have put themselves forward, but not because they're any more spiritual or would not have done probably the same thing. It's just the opportunity had been taken by James and John. And so you have all of this infighting. This is the team that Jesus has been trying to mold to take over church leadership. And here you got a couple weeks to go, and look at the crisis that these things are, the stage that this is. And I think this is one of the reasons, it's not recorded in Mark, but one of the reasons why it just, you know, in the next week where we see the upper room discourse and we see Jesus bathing the feet of his disciples to show them, again, what service, what being a servant is all about, what being humble is all about, and saying you need, as my disciples, you still need that lesson to understand that the pathway to greatness is that of being a servant, not of trying to advance yourself. Calling them to himself, now he's speaking to the 12, Jesus said to all of them, he said, look, you know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Their great men exercise authority over them. This is what the world's pattern of leadership looks like. Fleshly leadership looks like this, lording it over. Making sure that you're in charge, making sure that others know you're in charge, and using that position of authority to legislate whatever is to your advantage, and having them cater to you and having them serve your interests so that they are pawns in your great scheme of what you want to accomplish. And of course, sadly, in the church, this can too often be the case, as you have this masterminded program and the church members are pawns in the hands of the one who wants to orchestrate everything to basically serve his purposes and that type of thing. And Jesus says, look, that's the pattern of how business operates. It's the pattern of how our government operates. You don't see our political candidates talking about servant leadership as they debate among themselves and as they try to promote their campaigns. It's all about what they will dictate if they're in charge and how they will, you know, be able to accomplish this and accomplish that by their power and their strength and their lording it over, in essence. He says that's what's going to happen. That's why, you know, back in the Old Testament, God warned the Jews, you don't go after this concept of a king like the world has, because here's what a king will do. He's going to overtax you. You know, he's going to take all of your children and put them into service for him. He's going to want to accumulate horses and possessions and all for himself. All of this is going to serve himself. It's not going to be for your benefit. And so God had warned against this type, this model of leadership, and yet this is the pattern of the world and of the rulers of the Gentiles to lord it over. Now, the pattern of spiritual leadership, Jesus turns it all on its head. He says it's completely opposite. I like Alistair Begg here. The title for his message is Not So Among You. He says that's for this whole, he summed up this whole passage and says, not so among you. It shouldn't look this way when it comes to leadership in God's family, when it comes to spiritual leadership, leadership in the church. It shouldn't be this way. Whoever wishes to become great among you, the pathway is that of being a one who waits on others, being a servant, being one who is taking care of the needs of others. Whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. Not the position that people would say is important or prominent or respected or preeminent. No, you take the last place, but it's a very practical place to meet the needs of others, to serve others, and that's what God is going to honor, because that's the pathway to exaltation that God shows. It's the way of the cross that's the pathway to exaltation. And he says, and you know this is true because you can look at the model that the Son of God, who is the Son of Man, what he has provided as the model. And this verse of verse 45 is really probably the key verse in the book of Mark. If you look through the book of Mark and you want to have a verse that sums up the presentation of Jesus that's being given, probably the best summation here, the signature text for Mark's gospel, is verse 45. You could preach entire messages just from verse 45, as we see spiritual leadership modeled by the sacrificial service of the Son of Man. He says, for even, look at the model of the Son of Man. He did not come to be served. He did not come, as the Gentiles have demonstrated, to try to exercise authority and lord it over and have all things cater to him and serve him. He came to serve. He came to give his life a ransom for many. Now, you can't give your life a ransom for anyone, but you can follow the model to the extent of service and of humbling yourself and suffering for others and being sacrificial and unselfish in this sense. Edwards, he writes that this model of ministry cannot come from the secular order, but only from the unique way of Jesus, which defies the logic of this world and its fascination with dominance, with control, with results and outcomes. The key to the model that's both incarnated, Jesus demonstrated it in his own body, and commanded by virtue of his teaching. The key to the model, both incarnated and commanded by Jesus, is in the two verbs, to serve and to give. The reason why a servant is the most preeminent position in the kingdom of God is that the sole function of a servant is to give, and giving is the essence of God. The Son of Man said he came to give. He came to give his very life. He came to give it in a substitutionary manner, to take our place. The word anti is the Greek word that's used for, in place of. He came to give his life in place of, as a ransom, as a payment, not to Satan, as some would say, a payment to God, a propitiation, a satisfaction for the wrath of God. He says it's a ransom, it's for many. It's a particular, definite atonement that accomplishes the redemption of those for whom he came to save. It's accomplished not for all, it's accomplished for the many that he came to save. And he says this is what he came to do by way of his incarnation. This is the model of leadership that is pictured as we conclude in Philippians chapter 2 that we've mentioned many times before. This this pathway of the cross, the way of the cross, it's shown, it's spelled out for us in Philippians chapter 2, that it's only by way of humiliation, even to the point of death, it's only by this way of the cross that you can come to the point of exaltation. So in Philippians chapter 2, that very important statement in verse 3, where we should check all of our motivation, it says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. That's where you get to James and John, and you say, James and John, you got to read this verse. Do nothing by way of selfishness or empty conceit. It doesn't have to do with self-seeking or self-promotion. You need to operate from a motivation of humility of mind, where you regard one another as more important than yourselves. You can't look out merely for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. And then it moves into the model of Christ. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus. It talks about how he existed in all glory, how he set that aside. Verse 7, he emptied himself. What's involved in being a servant? He emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant. He is the one who has modeled servanthood for us. And then it says he actually humbled himself and was obedient to the point of death, even the death on the cross. And look at where this ends up. Look at where it leads. It says in verse 9, you can't shortcut this process. The disciples want to skip this and jump to glory. He says, you can't shortcut this. This is the pathway of the cross. Verse 9, for this reason also, God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so at the name of Jesus every knee will bow. There will be exaltation. There will be positions of power and of prominence, and there will be the worship of Jesus on the behalf of all mankind, heaven and earth. Every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Let's pray.